Steve Izard is a prize-winning writer, broadcaster, lawyer and research professor at Monash University and the J.M. Coetzee Centre for Creative Practice, University of Adelaide. He has written and edited books on topics ranging from Australia's Constitutional Convention to Australia's Population Challenge to children's books. Through his production company Artist Services, which he co-founded with Andrew Knight, he helped create and produced groundbreaking television shows including Fast Forward, Full Frontal, Big Girls Blouse, The McAuliffe Program and Sea Change, and hosted his own Gold Logie awarded TV show Tonight Live. He has also written for theatre, including the operas Banquet of Secrets and The Space Between, and the musical Vigil. He has contributed to public debate as President of Screen Producers Association, National Gallery of Victoria, Major Events Corporation, and the Vizard Foundation. He and his wife Sarah, his five children and grandchildren live in Melbourne. This is my chat with Steve. Welcome to the latest episode of the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. And today it's my great honour to be speaking with Steve Izard. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Morning, Greg. What a pleasure it is to be talking to you.
Thank you so much for your words, Steve, and it means a lot to be speaking to you. And of course, on the back of this amazing book, Nation, Memory, Myth, Gallipoli and the Australian Imaginary by Steve Izard through Melbourne University Press. And we're here to discuss the myth and everything else that goes on about. I guess April 25th it was, Steve, dawn when Australian troops waded ashore there on the Gallipoli Peninsula with 8,700 lives lost by the end of the campaign. What drove you to writing this amazing book?
I've always been, firstly, I'm Australian, and you'd have to be blind, deaf or dumb not to know the impact that Anzac has on, and the hold that Anzac has on our nation. And I remember when I was a little kid, so at, you know, three separate things that I've been reflecting on this, Greg, but three separate stories I just might share with you quickly. The first is when I live in Melbourne, and when I was a nine-year-old, we used to go to the dentist in town. We lived way out of Melbourne, but Mum would get dressed up. This is how old I am. Mum would get dressed up, put on a good hat, and I had to wear good shorts and, you know, my good socks and everything. And she'd take me to the dentist in town, and the biggest building in Melbourne in those days was the T&G building. It's still there. It's a little building these days, but it was the biggest one in town. And we'd go to a dentist. There were a lot of dentists up on the top floors there. I'd see the dentist, and we'd come back down. And we'd always, as a treat, she'd take us to, there was a milkshake shop and a chocolate shop called Ernest Hillier's. And we'd walk down from the dentist to get a chocolate milkshake, which is always ironic. You just had your teeth done, and now you're going to get them rotting. But I remember we were coming down on this. I'd been to the dentist, and as I say, I was 9 years old. It was a beautiful day. Turned out it was Remembrance Day. I didn't know that. It was the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And we came out, and the whole of busy Collins Street on that day, this is how long ago it was, all the cars pulled over.
Jeez.
And people stopped at Collins Street at the lights. Pedestrians kind of stopped walking. And I remember even a tram stopped going.
Oh, God.
Although in these days they stop all the time for 100 other reasons, but you know, literally, and Mum explained to me. I remember distinctly explained to me that it was Remembrance Day, and what that meant. And I remember that registering so powerfully that the city had come to a halt. I was at a school I went to a boys' school, and we had a teacher, a fill-in teacher. His name was Frank Potts, and Mr. Potts was so old. And he was a wizened, white old maths teacher, but he never taught us maths. He'd been in the First World War. He didn't listen. He did. We were only 12, and we looked forward to Mr. Potts coming and talking to us because we never learned anything about algebra or anything. He talked to us about being in the First World War. And when I think about it now, he was recounting only 2 metres away from me his experiences as an 18-year-old. So he was only 6 years older than us 12-year-olds when he'd enlisted. And the boys who were doing, in those days, HSC, high school certificate, who we'd see playing on the oval, the big boys, they were the same age as Mr. Potts was when he'd enlisted. And this kind of, it resonated with me. Mr. Potts would tell us how he was an Adelaide man. He just
Right.
got into uni at Adelaide Uni, and then he'd been enlisted and off he'd gone. And he would tell us of the boat trip he'd made and of arriving in England and training on Salisbury Plain, as he did, with all the other troops, and the King coming to visit and inspect the troops. And they were only just, he was a sapper, so he was involved in all the trenches and doing all that sort of work. And then he'd tell us about going to the front lines and his experiences there and seeing the dirt and losing mates and what it meant to be positive and how you steeled yourself. And we as 12-year-olds were mesmerized both by every aspect of the story. And Greg, he always told us one funny thing. And he told us, if you told us once, you told us 20 times. So much so that I kind of took this as a life lesson from him. He said, "Boys, if you ever see mustard gas coming toward you," like as if we're going to see mustard gas, but he said, "If you see mustard gas coming toward you and you can't get to your masks, urinate in a hanky and put that on your mouth because the chemicals in your urine will neutralize the gas." And I remember thinking, "Oh God!" I wandered around for about 20 years after that with a full bladder and a hanky in my, just on the off chance that I encountered mustard gas. And then we had another teacher. It just shows you how powerful things are when you're a kid. We had another teacher, Mr. Dobson, George Dobson, his name was, and he'd come to our school as a musician. He'd been one of the great trumpet players in Australia. He'd played overseas in American bands and in British bands and come back to Australia. He was so good. He had his own George Dobson's Trumpet Serenade after the war. And it was on the ABC and it was a very famous trumpet musical show. Anyhow, he sort of ran out the end of his life. And as a lot of music teachers do, he'd gone to our school to set up a band. It was like that film, the show, the play, The Music Man. So we'd got all brass instruments. And I remember as a 12-year-old, my brother was 11. He got the trombone, I got a trumpet, and Mr. Dobson set up a band. But not only would we play at fetes and things, we played at all of the commemorative functions. So we'd play Remembrance Day, we'd play on Anzac Day, and we'd play on special days. And Mr. Dobson himself had served during the war. And so he would instill in us the importance of what it was and what we were actually commemorating, of sacrifice and of the virtues of what it was. And that these were real men, real people just like us. And so this became more than just some musical thing. It became kind of important. And we this influenced us from a very early age. And I remember still, beautiful trumpeter, and he would play the Last Post on Remembrance Day and on Anzac Day, and we would hear, our school was in Kew, in the suburbs of Kew, and we'd all go out on the oval, all us boys, and he would play the Last Post on a sort of a ridge overlooking the whole of Kew, and I could still hear the echoes of that going all through the suburbs and the entire school, which was normally filled with clamoring kids, coming to dead silence. And I became kind of, in a sort of instinctive way, fascinated with not only the history of Gallipoli particularly, but actually with something different, with the story of Gallipoli and the power that it had to stop a nation, to have a hold over a nation, to kind of claim a nation psychologically and emotionally. And that's different from its history. And so years later, I was always interested in rituals and commemoration and the power of celebration as well, and of memory, as distinct from just physical, facts and history. How these events own us emotionally. And I've always thought that, I've been fascinated, for example, in families. We all know this. A family's more than just a list of birth dates and facts and income tax returns and mileage on an odometer or whatever it is. A family's held together emotionally, by how we celebrate, how we come together for a birthday, and how we speak our own kind of language that we all know, and things that would be kind of unintelligible to outsiders. We know them, and we have, you know, forms of addressing each other and private jokes and the birthday hats and the kind of weird Christmas celebrations and what we eat that other families don't eat. That's how a family's held together, you know, not by rational things, but by emotional things. And so it is for a footy club too. We all barrack teams and, you know, have our weird songs that we celebrate and the groups of that we go to the footy with and our little rituals about that. And so it is for a nation. And a nation, this is the work that I've been doing. A nation is more than just a system of legislation and an economic system and regulations. That's kind of the technical, the rational side of it. But the heart of it, the beating heart of it, is a system for harnessing emotions, for holding us together emotionally. And that's what rituals do. That's what commemorative practices do. That's what symbols do. And so often, commentators, historians in particular, overlook that emotional side of things in favour of just the sheer facts, just numbers and dates and sort of occurrences. But actually, what holds us together is that emotional pull. And we all know that. We all feel that. And politicians often forget this. And so, you know, they think that if I explain a new bit of legislation or something, that'll be enough, or a new system or a new thing that I'm proposing, no, what binds us together is emotional pull. And so I became kind of fascinated with how historians, a number of historians were saying of Gallipoli in particular, the event didn't happen exactly as the way that it's commemorated. You know, they didn't necessarily land at the wrong beach, and, you know, we weren't superior fighters necessarily, and our command wasn't as great as was said to be, and the British weren't as bad, and we didn't have more conscript, you know, we didn't have more volunteers than any other army, you know, and that particular campaign, the Gallipoli campaign, was a terrible failure. And it happened on foreign soil, and you put all of that together. So why would we celebrate that? I mean, you look at the facts, and those are the facts, and, you know, you can argue with them, but let's say they're the facts rationally. So looking at those rational facts, it's a failure of our campaign. So why on earth would a nation commemorate that? So let's get rid of it. Let's reduce it. Let's eliminate it. And what that line of thinking, which is rational thinking, fails to take into account is that there's an emotional side to these things. Nations are held together by emotions. And in the case of Gallipoli, those emotions are founded as, and this is what I'm speaking of, founding myths. Gallipoli acts as Australia's founding myths. And I don't use the word myth in a pejorative sense like an untruth, but in a classical sense, in the way the Greeks used it and a lot of other people use it, to mean a very sacred story. And sacred stories which hold communities together are founded often, particularly founding myths of nations, which all nations have, on a deep trauma. And the deep trauma of Gallipoli can't be just explained away as a failed campaign. It's a deep emotional, almost near extinction of the Australian nation emotionally. And we today often can't remember how deep that trauma was. But if we look back to, I mean, I know you know this intensely, Greg, and a lot of your listeners know this, but if we go back to the end of the First World War, it's worth just restating things that a lot of your people know, but it's worth restating it again. Out of a nation of just 4 million people, just on, you know, mid 4 million people.
Yes.
400,000 men enlisted. 400,000, 10% of the 4 million enlisted. Now, when you take out the women and the old and the young, the number of people who enlisted was massive. And of those, 60,000 people plus between 62, 65, around 60,000 people plus were killed. Another 150,000 people plus were injured. So that's 210 to 220,000 people out of 400,000 people either killed or injured. The greatest casualty rate of any Allied army in the First World War. And that trauma excluded really emotional trauma. They didn't really take that into account in those days. That was injured. So you put that into it. And that's before you get to the emotional trauma of the families at home. The women, the wives who've lost a husband, a son, a brother, an uncle, a grandpa, and all of the trauma of waiting, because in those days without communication, everything was by letter, not knowing, waiting. And we know, and it's, we can never say it too much. You could literally walk down any street and knock on any door, and someone's lost someone. Either directly or indirectly, or the neighbor has, and any butcher or baker, you go into any pharmacy, they've lost someone, any business, they've got their own roll of honor because half of them have gone off. The nation is devastated. And so, what a founding myth of nation does is it processes that grief. It processes that trauma. Rather, people are looking to make sense of it. At that point, they are left with loss and chaos. And a compelling narrative of nation, Gallipoli in particular, is a story which turns that trauma into kind of meaning. It says these men, these people, we as a nation didn't go this through this for no purpose. There was a point to it. We are, and it creates a destiny, a purpose, a narrative out of that loss. It creates sense out of it. And it does so in one critical way. It creates a compelling narrative. So the kind of structure of the narrative that we all share of Gallipoli is common to all other founding myths. It's a story of departure, adventure, and loss, and then of return with meaning. It's common to all great founding myths. But embedded in the founding myth of Gallipoli is one critical thing, and this too is common to all great myths of nation, and that is the ethos of the people of that nation. What are the distinctive characteristics that we say make us exceptional? And for us, we call that in our myth of Gallipoli, the Anzac spirit. So in that are the characteristics that we constantly talk about, which are a mateship, fighting and continuing, enduring hardship, a kind of larrikin sense of humor. All those shared cultural values and traditions and ideologies are embedded in that story. So the Anzac myth is more than just an historical recitation of some things that happened on some shores. It's not that at all. It's much more than that. It's a sacred, compressed narrative of Australian virtue. It's kind of a moral template of who we are, so that in looking back and commemorating what they did, that story isn't about the past. It's a commemoration of the values that we cherish for the future. It's something to look to as a template for how we should behave, where we should go, and what we should be as a people as we head into the future and face similar sorts of challenges, different though they might be, a bushfire, an international contagion, whatever. It's a template for how we should morally behave as we face those sorts of challenges in the future. That is kind of where I landed on Gallipoli. And so when, and let me just finish that, Greg, when an historian says, "Oh, those facts are wrong, we should get rid of that. We should get rid of that." Why would people bother to get up at 4 a.m. to commemorate that? Let's replace that with, let's replace it with a new myth that I like, one about, whatever. I'm beguiled by that because it suggests two things. One is that nations are run simply by a series of facts as opposed to emotion, as I've tried to say. Two, it's a kind of arrogance to say, I think everyone else has got it wrong, so I'd like to replace it. What everyone else is commemorating, they've got wrong. I'd like to personally replace it because they're not, you know, they're not academics like me. I'd like to top down replace it. Third, there's a bit of arrogance about that. But thirdly, it's ignoring the single most important thing that there is, that these myths are incredibly rare creatures that each nation doesn't choose to grow. They grow out of trauma and adversity, and they grow ground up, not top down by some politician or academic saying, this is what we're going to have and I'm going to make it happen. Nothing has lasted for 100 years or 200 years, or in the case of some nations, for 500 or 600 years by virtue of that happening. Every founding myth that resonates and endures grows ground up out of the suffering and trauma of the real people at grassroots level. That is the engine room of a national myth.
Yes. Yes, Steve, so well said. And I could listen to you talk about that forever. And I guess bless Frank Potts and bless George Dobson for implanting in you such an interest. And I guess the dentist visit too, when you went out there in Collins Street and saw all the cars stopping and everything. I too went to a dentist in Collins Street, and I'm roughly your age, so perhaps we bumped into each other. That's incredible. Steve, yeah. I guess what is it that's inclusive about the Gallipoli myth, and what is it that excludes? You've written about that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
As I said, every national myth is a kind of a compression of who we are, of each nation, of who we are, what makes them distinctive. You know, if you want to, if you're in any doubt as to whether these kind of emotional things are important to people, think only, I mean, you don't have to look back in history, think of the conflicts that are going on at the moment in the world.
Mm.
Think of Gaza. You know, part of that's a rational conflict over resources and territory, but the most of that conflict is irrational. It's emotional. It's about mm-hmm. people believing emotionally that they've got an entitlement to a homeland that exceeds rationality. Think of what's happening in the Ukraine. A massive proportion of that conflict is about irrational, emotional beliefs about where is my homeland, who are my people, what binds us together, irrational thoughts. You know, much of what is happening in America, much of Britain's exit from the EU, and so we go through the world, is put down not necessarily to rational beliefs, although there's a component of that, but much more critically, to a people feeling about who they are and what binds them together. In this book, I interrogate that, and I say that there's three kind of critical components to any nation that binds them together. One is a sense of kinship, that is, who are we as a people? The second is a sense of belonging to a homeland. Where is the homeland to which we belong? And the third element is the cultural and historical memories and beliefs that bind us together. So if you put those three things together, who are we, where do we belong, and what do we do? What makes us different as a people? And those three thoughts, and I talk about those at some length in the book, but those three thoughts are entangled to create a sense of exceptionalism. And I don't mean that in a sort of a superior way, just in a way of difference. What is it that makes Australian people different? Different for the better and for the worse, but every nation has a sense of exceptionalism, that we are somehow different and exceptional in our own unique way.
Yes.
And you only have to look at Australians, you know, the way we behave overseas, the way we conduct ourselves at Olympic Games with our Aussie orga, the pride we feel when we see the green and gold, how we travel the world, how we feel getting on a Qantas plane. These are feelings about Australian exceptionalism. And it doesn't mean that we were all agreeing about everything at the time, but this is a feeling. In our heart of hearts, we feel something about being Australians. And if anyone is in doubt about that feeling and the way we commemorate that feeling, they only need look at, for example, on Anzac Day, how sports have re-embraced this huge national commemoration. And now 100,000 people who've gone to the MCG to watch a footy game, again, with two teams who hate each other, and they've got pies in their hands and they've got beers and they're going to scream and yell as much as any people can scream and yell. And they've been yabbering and talking and got their colours and they're ready to go. But the minute that last post is played, the minute the lights go down, every person, 100,000, they rise in silence and stand there. Not because they've been told to do it, not because there's a regulation that requires them to do it, because there's a common understanding of what it is to be Australian, of what binds them together, of the virtues that hold them together. And so it is for every dawn service throughout the country. You know, people aren't ordered to get out of bed and, you know, and often on a miserable rainy day and front up, 50,000 people to the shrine in Melbourne, a similar amount, Cenotaph, a similar amount in Canberra. And so we go through to the tiny little places, from Port Douglas to Port Lincoln. And you literally go around the country. People have got up and they've done this because there's a sense of belonging. And every people, from families to sporting clubs to nations, needs to belong, wants to belong, looks for the meaning of belonging. We're a communal creature. We need to belong. And we commemorate that belonging, not only for the present, but as a form of destiny, as a form of continuity. Those who've belonged before and sacrificed themselves for our belonging, we today, and those in the future, our children, our children's children, there's a great sense of belonging in continuity, not just geographically, but temporally through time. And that's what we're commemorating.
Yeah, totally amazing, totally amazing. And the way you put it, I tell you what, we're here discussing nation memory myth, Gallipoli and the Australian Imaginary, with Steve Izard, the author of Melbourne University Press. Steve, look, just what is it, the Anzac spirit that we believe that allows us to spot BS before a lot of other countries seem to? I mean, for example, it's hard to imagine a character like Donald Trump gaining entrance into Australian politics, but some politicians seem to forget that, and they will recite what they believe is a winning formula, but Australians seem to see through that sort of thing.
Oh, look, there's all, it's, I mean, we've all got our views about that. I think there is one of the great virtues of Australian character. And of course, it's always evolving. But one of, and so, you know, it's, you know, these things are in broad brushstrokes and so they're always just generalisations. But one of the great generalisations, and it's true, of Australian character that is epitomised in the Gallipoli, the Anzac story, but it had its foundations in the bushmen, in the laconic bushmen, and in the sort of the larrikins of the late 19th century, when Australia was just before independence as a nation federation, but then became kind of consolidated in the First World War, is the larrikin sense of humour. And the larrikin sense of humour is kind of critical to the Anzac story, but it's critical to who we are. And it's something that it relates to me because, I've made a living in other areas of doing comedy shows. And it's basically taking the piss. When there is the greatest virtue in taking the piss, in having a laugh, because it deflates all of those pomposity, all of the, people who are getting up themselves, all of that, We are good at pulling the rug out. And it arose probably, it's often talked about, through our establishment as a penal colony. We were dismissive of authority, and the two go hand in hand. Another great Australian trait that's kind of embedded in the Gallipoli story is the way we are dismissive of authority. Well, that and the larrikin sense of humour go hand in hand, don't they?
That's right. That's right.
Because, you know, a sense of humour is all about taking down power and power structures to some extent, having a go at someone who's too up themselves. You know, it's embodied in the classic thing of the sort of the fat businessman wearing a top hat, slipping on a banana peel. That is kind of the embodiment of that. So we're finely tuned to all of that, and we're practiced at it. And Gallipoli kind of is enshrines that virtue. But one thing I would say, though, Greg, I think it's really critical. You talk about America. You know, one of the reasons that things can go wrong in a country or go sideways is because there are vacuums. And so we don't
That's
discuss
right.
things. And so
Yes.
the vacuum is filled by those who are prepared to occupy it all of a sudden with excessive or bizarre or unusual or extreme views. But that their capacity to occupy that space only arises because we've sort of been too hesitant to have these hard discussions about what's right, what's wrong. You know, people are warned off having discussions about those things.
Yes,
There's
so true.
a kind of censorship about, oh, we're not allowed to discuss. I have the opposite view. I think that the most robust democracies are founded on full and frank discussions, sometimes pain, and sometimes ones we passionately disagree with someone, but we engage with them and we have the discussions in a civil way, because that is the very nature of the society we live in. And I actually think it's really interesting. This goes to a topic of censorship, which is not the subject of my book. But you know, I think it's really interesting that after the Second World War, indeed after the First World War, but after the Second World War, so many of the soldiers and the people who came back and the society that they then formed didn't ban discussion of books. They had first-hand contact with the enemy and with a lot of the ideologies that had given rise to the conflict, whether it was fascism or Nazism or whatever. They had more than anyone a reason to hate those ideologies, more than anyone. But on their return, they didn't ban all of the books and the literature and the movies and the material that related to those ideologies that had cost them and their mates their lives. The opposite. They understood that the very thing they'd been fighting for was a free democracy in which those ideologies, appalling though they might be, could be discussed, interrogated, and dismissed on
Yes.
rational grounds or irrational grounds, because that is the nature of the very society, the democratic institution that we live in and that they had fought and died for. So the idea that generations later, that we take umbrage on behalf of those guys and start to close down those areas of discussion in a way that they never did, but could have, but chose not to do, because it was the very antithesis of all that they'd fought for and of their conception of the civil society that we live in.
Yeah, now, Steve, I agree so much with you on that. And this could go on to another discussion. And I hope at another time we get an opportunity to speak more. I'm in total agreement. My parents were of different political persuasion, but still love them, you know?
Yeah, 100%. That's how we work in a civil society,
Correct.
because we're bound together by greater values. And the greatest values that we live with in this society are kind of captured in the Anzac myth. I would make one further point, Greg. The Anzac myth and Gallipoli is an imperfect thing. It arose out of a war that we didn't intend to have, trauma that we didn't intend to suffer. It's a particular story, a great story, and a sacred story. But we should have other myths as well. We don't make, well, you'll never find a perfect myth, And a society's not made perfect by chopping down the greatness that we've got and looking for a more perfect one.
That's
The
right.
opposite.
That's exactly right.
We keep the greatness we've got and add others to it.
You've been absolutely fantastic, Steve. And for the education and interest and entertainment of all, we thank you on so many levels for your history. And we're amazed that so much can be compacted into one human being. You're incredible. Steve, thank you so much for being on the Last Post Radio Show podcast series. It's been a blessing, and we thank you. And Steve's book, Nation, Memory, Myth, Gallipoli in the Australian Imaginary, Melbourne University Press. Go out and get it.
Thanks. I really enjoyed the chat. It was great, mate.
You're listening to Greg T. Ross and the Last Post Radio Show.